Me. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. You get to listen to things I say as your reward for tuning in at this time. Good for you. Made a sound decision there to tune into the show today. All right, that's the last of that. Today, the interview that didn't happen yesterday with Kelly Riddell, I think. Yes, sir. She's the lady what half wrote them Washington Times stories about Hillary Clinton and Libya. Huge. Have you seen the series? They're all, three out of four of them are running on antiwar.com at the top of the page right now. Three-part series and audio from 2011 and Hillary's relentless push to convince Obama to go to war with Libya. And, boy, really something else. Great work they've done. I'm going to ask her a bunch of questions if I can. Also, our good friend Ray McGovern is going to be back on the show because the Brookings Institution has put out this thing about how we need to arm the Ukrainians. And then, of course, all the news from the White House is that Obama's considering doing just that. So we're going to be talking with Ray McGovern. And I might be setting up that interview a bit in the next segment as well. A couple of news things that I don't know if I'll have time to elaborate on. Maybe I can get back to them later if I have the time and if it matters. But I just kind of want to mention real quick. Did you see this morning? It just broke. Look at my Twitter feed. The ISIS guys are putting out tweets of supposed, looks pretty legit to me, unfortunately, alleged, supposed footage of them setting a Jordanian pilot on fire. They got him locked in a cage like an animal. You know, like an American jail cell kind of thing. He's outside, apparently soaking in flammable liquids. And they burn him to death and film the whole thing. And there have been rumors about this, apparently, from January the 8th is what Twitter is saying this morning. And then now it's confirmed. Apparently they killed him a month ago. So I don't know what's going to happen. The Jordanians, the king, Abdullah, America's king, Abdullah. Oh, he doesn't own us. We own him. But still. He's got the divine right, you see, granted to him by the British. Anyway, the king, the divine king of Jordan, has said, if you kill our pilot, we will kill every ISIS prisoner we have. So I guess we'll see whether that happens or not. I'd just like to point out that ISIS needs war. Why? Because ISIS is a bunch of warriors. They're fighters. That's who they are. That's what they do. That's all they do. They need enemies. Just like George Bush and Barack Obama need enemies. The Caliph Ibrahim needs enemies so that he can say, rally around me so we can fight the enemies. That's pretty much how it works. Read your Bob Hicks. And so this is what's behind what Lawrence Wright calls the strategy of savagery. Why do these ISIS guys go around crucifying people to death and cutting their heads off and setting them on fire? And then did you see the pictures they put out a few days ago? Only read later, and I don't know, secondhand thing, I guess I don't know this for a fact, but supposedly the guys that they were throwing off of the top of tall buildings, two guys, they put out pictures of, they had crucifixions and stonings and all this stuff going on in these pictures, but two of their prisoners, if I remember right, with their hands tied behind their back, were just hurtled off of like 10-story buildings, and there's pictures of them on their way down. Apparently they'd been accused of homosexuality. And that's just their so-called criminal justice. When it comes to fighting the Shia, just go look at LiveLeak and just watch the ISIS guys with AK-47s mowing down basically a parking lot full of people at a time. Mostly soldiers, but not always soldiers. Sometimes just for being Shia. And so what's the point? Well, same reason that Zarqawi bombed marketplaces full of Shia back in 2006. To get a reaction. To provoke the Shiite militias into committing atrocities so that they can say, look, you need us. Same thing here. And what's better public relations than having the Americans? Never mind the Jordanians. The Jordanians are nothing when it comes to benefiting our enemy by attacking them. As this one ISIS kook said back when they beheaded James Foley, the first American journalist that they murdered. Here we are burying the first American crusader in Dabiq, eagerly waiting for the remainder of your armies to arrive. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the wrong quote. That's from Peter Kasich. There's another one from when they murdered James Foley. That's from the murder of Kasich. Oh, man. I'm sorry. I thought I had one from Foley. Anyway, Jason Ditz has all the quotes at news.antiwar.com when the bombing first started in August, where they said, I think Jason's smart aleck headline is, ISIS condemns, celebrates American attacks. Yep. That's how it works. So you see right there. Okay, now the other thing is that I got to say is about the measles, and thank goodness I've only got a couple of minutes to talk about the measles. I'm going to refrain from taking sides in a big part of the debate. I only want to take part in a small part of the debate. Everyone is making it out like Rand Paul is some insane lunatic for saying vaccines should be voluntary, that it should be up to the parents to decide. Now, he said some things that people want to challenge on scientific grounds about just how safe they are or not. I'll let you guys debate that. It's off topic for this show. But what's on topic for this show is, are you kidding me? That supposedly is an extreme conspiracy kook position to take, that it should be up to parents to decide? You saw on TV that 100 people have measles, and so that's it. There's, look, everyone, a crisis of some proportion. So, therefore, that's it. Last vestige of freedom in that area must go. Didn't you see the TV? I'm supposed to be emotional right now. And so even though in the supermajority of states, almost all of them, more than a supermajority of the 50 states, that's the law. Except maybe in some cases on very specific inoculations or something. But on virtually all inoculations in virtually all the states, that's the law, that it's up to the parents. Now, sometimes they won't let you go to the government school unless you have an inoculation or these kinds of things. But still, that's public policy in the entire United States of America. And for people to act like it's crazy, it's insane, it's madness, it's so irresponsible to advocate that it should be up to anyone but government to decide. How do they get their phallus that deep into your brain, where they just take over your brain for you and make you think and say these things? You know what it means to say it should be mandatory? It means severe consequences for those who would resist. It means making criminals out of people who disagree with you. It means maybe, quite actually, necessarily, it means families destroyed. But, oh, well, whatever, you're on your high horse, so you know better. When has freedom ever served anyone well? Pisses me off. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'll say one more thing about the big, I'll say two more things about the big measles scare and whatever. The first one is, you ever notice how TV just tells you what to be scared about all the damn time? Oh my God, the SARS. Oh my God, the H1N1. Oh God, the bird flu. Oh God, the Ebola. Oh no, whatever will become of us because of all the Honduran child refugees. Whatever. The Muslims. You ever look out your window? Ever participate in the actual world and wonder, where are all these crises actually affecting me, like they say, so much? As I was complaining in the last segment, oh my God, 100 people have measles. Well, that's the end of the argument. No more dissent from the vaccine consensus for anyone anymore. You know, if you ask my Twitter feed, which is, you know, basically liberal journalists, because most journalists are liberals, and so that's who I follow, and I see what they think and what they, their consensus that they all come to so quickly about everything. And that is that, hey, liberty means freedom to disagree with me, and that is unacceptable. And I know that they're saying, well, yeah, but measles spread around, and some kids are weak in immune systems and effect and that, this and that. Yeah, uh-huh. And so you're saying that a mother and a father ought to have their child taken away from them and put in foster care, and they ought to have to go to jail if they refuse to obey your dictate. Is that right? The government ought to come and take their child away and destroy their family if they don't go along. I saw one the other day, the head of BuzzFeed or Mediaite or one of those tweeted out a tweet of a doctor who said not just any parent who disagrees with vaccines is invited to leave his practice and go find another doctor, but he calls CPS on all of them. Really? Because what, in your imagination, that always just works out great for everyone, huh? Much better than a kid possibly getting rubella. And then, so the point of this verbal essay here is that people are stupid. People don't have the imagination to think about what they're even really advocating, about the consequences of their actions. And again, to the liberal media consensus that I follow on Twitter, the only reason anyone wouldn't want to get their kid vaccinated is if there's some backwards, ridiculous right-wing Christian who believes that the earth is 6,000 years old and hates the scientific method and thinks it's a conspiracy against them. Well, that's funny, because there are actually a lot of people who do not fit that description who feel that way, including a bunch of PhD-holding hippies. There's a piece at the Daily Beast that you're much more likely to find anti-vaccine people living in Santa Monica. You know, the heart of Hillary Clinton country. Because that's where everybody wants everything organic and they don't want the slightest little bit of a... I heard that there's some kind of preservative in there that might be a toxin. And I don't like a toxin. So, that doesn't matter. What matters is that they convince themselves that anyone who disagrees with them on this is also the same kind of person who they have so little respect for that they don't mind pushing them around at all. They don't mind deciding for a bunch of Leander-living rednecks. They're barely humans at all anyway. So how dare they object? Never even mind. Right? You're a libertarian like me. You can see easy. Whoa, they're talking about cops with guns coming and major confrontations and maybe people getting shot and women and babies screaming and crying, afraid they'll never see each other again because the cops have come to enforce some vaccine mandate. To a liberal, what does it mean? Yeah, everyone will get vaccines now. Yeah, if we make it mandatory, then everyone will get vaccines now. And they don't have to imagine the right-wing, reactionary, fascist, totalitarian police action that will come down on those who resist. Because they're stupid. Because they're liberals. And they wouldn't be liberals if they weren't stupid in the first place. Find me a liberal media person on Twitter saying, yes, if it comes to SWAT teams coming and killing people and kidnapping their children to give them measles vaccines, then yes, it's worth it. Find me someone who says that ever. No, because they don't have to deal with that reality at all. And you know what other reality they don't have to deal with? And these are the liberals. They don't have to deal, and it's their people who would be, again, the most likely to be anti-vaxxers in the first place, to not trust corporate food, right? Or corporate medicine. I guess it's people on the right and left who are kind of alternative medicine types and whatever. I've always been very healthy, so I haven't had much of an interest in that kind of stuff, but just because I'm lucky, let me knock on wood here. But point being that they don't ask themselves, well, how come when we shout at people that, hey, you stupid idiot, the scientific study is in and it says everything's fine, so stop being stupid and take the shot, how come they don't do it? It's only because of how stupid they are. But that's only because of how stupid the liberals are, that they're not even asking about their fellow Santa Monica liberals. How could you be so stupid? Well, maybe they just don't trust the system. Maybe they know for a fact that America is a corrupt fascist dictatorship. They know that there is no accountability. There is no accountability. And so, if all the studies say it's fine, suspect the study. Or just assume that the people who did the study are so self-interested that they screwed up. Like the same people who told you that the most important thing is for you to eat whole wheat all day, every day, for the last six generations or whatever, when it turned out that was what was killing you. Everybody knows that if the FDA says it's okay, that doesn't mean anything. It might put a hole in your heart. And if the FDA says it's not okay, that doesn't mean anything too. It might have been the thing could have saved your mother's life, but the government wouldn't let her even try it. Everybody knows that everything is corrupt. Everyone knows that no state legislator means well, other than for themselves. Everyone knows that America is corrupt. And so if someone says, hey, trust the shot, they don't. Why should they? You tell them, yeah, it's got formaldehyde and aluminum and these things in it, but the formaldehyde is just a tiny little bit and don't worry about it. They go, well, I am worried about it. And you say, but the aluminum just makes it better. And they go, really, aluminum? Why? How does that make it better? Teach me. Show me why the aluminum makes it better. And if they say, yeah, but you get more aluminum if you eat blueberries, then they wonder, yeah, but is it the same kind of aluminum exactly? Does it metabolize out of the body the same way? What about this, that, the other thing I read that said actually it's different? They don't ever answer that. Their only answer is you must think the earth is 6,000 years old. So it's no longer up to you. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Kelly Riddell. She's co-author with Jeffrey Scott Shapiro at the Washington Times of this very important three-part series about Hillary Clinton and the Libya war. The first one is now titled secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan war. Welcome to the show. Kelly, how are you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. Thrilled to see this journalism here. Great piece of work that you guys put together here about how we got into the war in Libya back in 2011. First of all, I guess, you know, the most important point is in the former headline. It's still in the URL. She was undercut, not by the tape. She's not undermined by the tapes. She was undermined by the Pentagon tried to stop her from getting us into the war in Libya. And I guess it was already known that Robert Gates had advised against it. But I don't think we had any idea of just how hard the Pentagon tried to thwart her ambition here. Can you tell us, first of all, I guess, about what you know about Mullen and Ham, who is Mullen was the head of CENTCOM, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Ham was the head of AFRICOM at the time. Can you tell us about their concerns here?
Well, I mean, their concerns were that no U.S. national interests were at stake, and they couldn't see, in terms of the civil war that had broke out in Libya, they didn't know who the rebels were or if they were terrorists, if they had connections to al-Qaeda, who they were to cut a deal with. So they knew Muammar Gaddafi. They knew that he was a bad guy, but they also knew that he was helping the CIA collect a lot of counterterrorism intelligence. He was keeping lists of al-Qaeda operatives, and he was really becoming a strategic asset for our intelligence communities. So they knew if he was unseated or gone, that intel would be lost. But not only that, but then who would come in to take his place? They were unsure about what would transpire if he was removed. And so they advised Secretary Clinton at the time, as well as the president, to stay out of the conflict, to let it resolve itself. And we know from the intelligence that was gathered that Muammar Gaddafi was about to regain stability of his country, about to regain control of the country, and that would have happened had NATO not started bombing, mm-hmm. had not started its airstrikes. But, you know, Admiral Mullen was so concerned about this that, I mean, they gave their public statements around March 15th when the policy decisions were being made. But shortly thereafter, around March 20th, you know, General Ham was approached by the regime, generals in the regime, to negotiate a 72-hour truce, a ceasefire that he took authority on himself to do, and that was shot down by the State Department. And then we know that the Joint Chiefs team opened up a direct channel to Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif Gaddafi, in an effort to try to transition him to be the next leader of Libya. All you know, outside of what the State Department was doing at the time. Mm.
Well, it's interesting here that, there's so many interesting things here. One of them is, as far as the original motive, I remember back at the time interviewing someone from Amnesty International saying, oh, yes, it's all true. Gaddafi's just mass murdering all of these people all over the place. He's bombing every protest from the air with airstrikes and all these things. And yet you guys quote Human Rights Watch, who I guess weren't on contract for the State Department at the moment, saying, well, you know, it's all kind of overblown, and better, reaffirming what was my assumption in the first place, which I think has been borne out by Michael Hastings' reporting and now further by yours, that what Hillary Clinton was really interested in here more than anything was a PR stunt. Because after Tunisia and especially after Egypt, it looked really bad that America had been backing this fascist dictator, the military dictator of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, who Hillary Clinton had called her family friend and who she tried to prop up and keep in power as long as she possibly could. And then when he finally was overthrown anyway, she realized, oh, no, Uncle Sam looks really bad here. So we need to try to pretend like we're on the side of the little guy against the dictators. And so they stabbed Gaddafi in the back, who they brought in from the cold in 2003. But he was, you know, no Mubarak, I guess. He was expendable to them. So she decided to back the rebels against him, sort of like in this cartoon of, you know, America on the side of the poor rebels against the evil dictator, even though, as you guys describe here, the poor rebels were a bunch of veterans of the Iraq War, where they fought with Zarqawi, the Libyan Islamic fighting group of, you know, al-Qaeda and Iraq veterans.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make two very good points here. The first in that the humanitarian crisis was overblown, and that is what led the U.S. to sign the U.N. resolution. The resolution was based on an imminent humanitarian crisis, and we have proved that there was no imminent humanitarian crisis. That given we've been briefed by intelligence, and they knew at the time that there was 400 people, the insurgents that were killed in the civil war, and that they had no population estimates of how many people were in the city of Benghazi, which they were worried would lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. When we asked intelligence directly, were you concerned that this was going to be another Rwanda-like scenario, which Hillary Clinton stated was going to happen had we not gotten involved, they simply said, no, this was nothing like Rwanda.
To be specific here, you guys quote the military saying Gaddafi only had 2,000 men. Susan Rice was telling the United Nations that he had given his army, some giant army, armed them with guns and Viagra, and they were raping their way across all of Libya, and they were going to murder every last man, woman, and child in Benghazi. Obama said this would be like killing everyone in Charlotte, North Carolina. And yet, he had 2,000 men to accomplish this with, huh?
Yeah, and if you look at the map of Libya, he was marching his way from Tripoli to Benghazi, which was the rebel stronghold. And on his way, on his troops' march through the cities to Benghazi, they were sparsely populated. They were mostly, you know, oil ports or people had evacuated. So the fact that, you know, there was like all of this, that's untrue and that's misleading. And that's what we were told by the U.S. military, that they had been keeping an eye on it. But you know, he was really unopposed in this march forward because the civilians had either fled or had joined the side of the regime. And that there was no populist strongholds really until you got to Benghazi.
Mm-hmm. And now I know you guys couldn't cover everything in this series here, but it seems important as far as the precedent set for what's a good enough excuse to start a war about a crisis that's taking place wholly within the borders of a sovereign state and member of the UN. In the case of the Kosovo war, there was, you know, Kosovo was kind of de facto separate from Serbia by then anyway, kind of in a way. And plus, Bill and Hillary lied that 100,000 men, women, and children had already been murdered. Now, it wasn't true, but they said, look, there are 100,000 dead civilians, so we have to intervene. In this case, it was wholly hypothetical. And so, therefore, Kelly, you can't prove it's not true either, right? Because, hey, there could have been a massacre. And now we have that as the standard for when the president can get America involved in a kinetic action without the consent of Congress, totally in violation of the War Powers Act, based on Hillary's imagination, the Secretary of State's imagination.
And that is exactly what concerns a lot of people that we interviewed. I mean, and that's why you see we went to the different embassies and got foreign reaction, and that's why you see countries like Russia and Brazil that they abstained from the UN vote because they were worried that, you know, if they voted for it, then war could be justified in any sorts of means given this liberal interpretation. I spoke with Senator Rand Paul last week.
Hold that thought right there. We'll pick this up on the other side with Kelly Riddell from the Washington Times. This great series, you got to go read it, all about Hillary getting us into the war in Libya. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Okay, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Kelly Riddell. She's the co-author of this series at The Washington Times. First is Exclusive Secret Tapes Undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan War. Second is Hillary Clinton's WMD Moment. U.S. intelligence saw false narrative in Libya. And third, secret Benghazi report reveals Hillary's Libya war push armed Al-Qaeda-tied terrorists. And then there's a sidebar, listen to the audio tapes of Denis Kucinich and the Pentagon explaining what was going on here as the Pentagon tried to stop the rush to war. And I'm sorry, I forget if it was your piece or not. I know Josh Rogan had a piece that I found from back in 2011 where he talked about they had a big fight on, I guess, sitting there on the couches in the Oval Office. And it was the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Security Advisor and his deputy lined up against the war.
Yeah.
And then the activists were for it. And the president sided with Rice, Power, and Hillary Clinton over the Pentagon, saying that there was a war that they did not want to partake in.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. That is just incredible.
That is exactly true. I mean, this was very much advocated by, you know, Secretary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power, all arguing on behalf that they didn't want another Rwanda to happen. They didn't want to see another genocide take place on their watch. And if you look at Samantha Power, I mean, she wrote an entire book on the Rwanda genocide and felt very passionate about that. And from what we heard from people that were in that meeting, it was emotionally driven. It was an emotionally based argument that took precedent over the facts of the matter and the situation, the real-time intelligence and situation on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then especially when you're talking about the military has got Gaddafi talking about a deal where he will step down if they will only promise him safe passage. He will leave power. He will negotiate. He will allow African Union troops to come and stand between him and his enemies in order to enforce the ceasefire. Not good enough. Hillary Clinton had General Hamm call off the negotiations at that point.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it was when we asked the military, you know, why was this called off? Why do you think the State Department rejected this? They basically said that, you know, at that point they had come too far. It was that they needed to save face. It became a face saving measurement almost, you know, because if we were to call everything off, you know, then it would have made the State Department and the White House look bad. Like, why did we go in there the whole time? So then the whole thing became regime change.
That's what the generals told you? The military men told you that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you can't have a regime change by basically keeping in power the Gaddafi regime, which was going to happen. They were thinking that Saif Gaddafi would take the reins from his father, and his father would. The Gaddafis also were very clear that they were not going to leave Libya, that they would stay there. I mean, that's where they were. That was their nation, and they weren't going to leave, but Muammar would step down. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't good enough. That was going to, you know, that basically at the time, and as far as the rhetoric had ramped up to such a point where, you know, we couldn't accept those terms.
Mm-hmm. And now, can you tell us which general or officer or who it was that told you that was really the reason, was saving face at that point?
You know, all of our conversations with the military and intelligence community, you know, we can't reveal who we spoke with for fear of retaliation. A lot of them hold current positions that, you know, spoke to us only on the condition of anonymity.
Sure. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was a named source or not, but worth a try there. and now, so there's a major intelligence crisis kind of going on here, too. You guys compare it to the WMD, but we have, first of all, it's basically a hoax. The military doesn't believe at all that all these civilians are about to be killed, 100,000 of them, as the president ended up claiming. But at the same time, too, they're saying that, hey, these are a bunch of jihadists are basically the armed rebels to back here. And are we sure we want to do this? And then, but they were, and I'm kind of confused about this point, Kelly. It sounds like you have them saying how frustrated they are that they aren't able to get this information to the president, that somehow these generals, these guys have to go through Hillary, but they don't. They have Robert Gates and they have Admiral mm-hmm. Mullen on their side. Mm-hmm. And so why did they feel so stymied as far as actually getting real information to the president before he made the decision.
I feel that that is an inherent conflict with the military, that they're not policy guys. They are strategy guys, and they are, you know, once the orders have been given, they are on board with that mission. And to say that they're not on board makes them appear, it's not their directive, right? They're at the directive of the United States president, and the orders that he gives them, they need to follow. And so when they were saying that they didn't quite trust what was coming, what Clinton was providing to the White House, and that was for their own internal strategy, because they didn't know, to be quite frank, they didn't know what the end terms or what the end result was going to look like if the National Transition Council would become the government, or what was going to happen in Libya, or what the U.S. strategy was going to be in Libya after Gaddafi was removed. And the president hadn't articulated that, and neither had the State Department. So they were kind of trying to stay ahead of it and try to think on their feet and develop strategies in different scenarios of what might play out in their own best interest, because they knew that they would be called upon then to execute whatever strategies. But they didn't know what their exact directives were, so they were just coming up with all these different scenario plannings as to when they were called upon, that they'd have different options to pursue. Mm-hmm.
And now, I'm sorry for jumping around, but back to the Rwanda thing for a minute here. It kind of strikes me that it's sort of policy by analogy that, well, you know, here's the thing that happened one time and this is like that, but yeah, I can see how that could be part of an argument, but... Of course, when you're deciding about something like this, Libya is not Rwanda. In fact, it's a lot more like Iraq, come to think about it. If even just looking at it on a map, it's a little bit more like Iraq than Rwanda. And it seems like that must have played into the conversation here about even Hillary at the time and Obama at the time both said, hey, we have to be very cautious because who knows what might happen when we're done, before they did it anyway.
Yeah, I think another thing to when you're making a genocide comparison like that of Rwanda, is the timeline. What happened in Rwanda didn't happen over the course of one or two days. It was over a 100-day period. And what the president and what the Secretary of State was arguing at the time, if we don't get involved in these next few days, you know, there's going to be a massive genocide. And that, if you look in the history of genocides, the killings of hundreds of thousands of people doesn't happen in a 48-hour time span. That's just unrealistic. So that's unreasonable just on the face of things.
Mm-hmm. And now, so did you guys get much of a temperature on how it was that Obama actually decided to choose the Hillary position when, I mean, I know he's a Democrat and he has to act extra tough and all that, but then again, he's got his right flank entirely covered. He's got a Republican Secretary of Defense saying, don't do it, and he chooses to do it anyway. Did they tell you much about, you talked about, you had sources at that meeting, what he said about this, how he decided to go for this?
Well, I think, and this is from, you know, some expert sources outside of the military that said, you know, at the time, if you take it in historical context, and you said you brought up the Arab Spring and how we were caught flat-footed there, and the president also in the 2011 time period was looked upon as a weak in foreign policy and kind of as weak within the military. And him and Ben Rhodes had come up with this concept, this idea of leading from behind. And I think what we've been told from experts that have analyzed this period is that he saw this as a perfect vehicle to test out this lead from behind theory, in that he would take action with the UN, it'd be NATO-backed, the U.S. would go in for the first 2 weeks with the military, but then they'd pass it along to NATO, something that's been unprecedented in U.S. history or kind of warfare history. And then it'd be a perfect example, an execution of this theory that he could define his foreign strategy on. So it was very political for him.
Yeah. And it's right the same year we're finally pulling out of Iraq, too. So it's a little bit of cover for that, maybe, politically wise, I mean. Anyway, great reporting. Thank you so much for your time on the show today.
Thank you.
That's Kelly Riddell, y'all. She's at the Washington Times. Great three-part series on Hillary and Libya.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in again.
She was good, huh?
My new favorite Washington Times reporter. I actually didn't have one before that. But anyway, yeah, good stuff there. All right, next up is our good friend Ray McGovern. He formerly was an analyst at the CIA, the head of their Soviet division, I found out only recently. I guess I should have asked previously. He read the presidential daily briefs to Vice President George H.W. Bush in the Reagan years and since retired and helped found Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which is a group of veteran intelligence professionals who write memos to high-level government executives saying, please stop doing the terrible things that you're doing from time to time. Sound advice they usually never listen to. Also, he is a great writer. You can find his columns at consortiumnews.com, and we run them all at antiwar.com as well. And also, he will give speeches. You can find him at raymcgovern.com and find the group Tell the Word there and get with him about giving a speech to your group. But he won't be able to give one soon because it looks like he might be going to prison. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you? Are you going to prison?
Well, that tomorrow will tell, Scott. I'm in the New York City criminal court tomorrow to face charges of criminal trespass and resisting arrest. So if this goes through, then no one will dare try to listen to David Petraeus ever again unless they're part of the club. All I was trying to do was to have them honor my ticket at the 92nd Street Y in New York. I had had a ticket purchased for me, and they wouldn't let me in. So long story short, I was arrested, pretty much brutalized, put in the New York City prison system down in the tombs for the night and arraigned the next day. And now I have to go before the judge and explain why I was trying to get in to see Petraeus with a ticket.
Well, what were you going to do? Ask him how many wars he lost?
Well, Scott, I had about 20 questions I wanted to ask him, and I narrowed it down to one or two. There was a question and answer period, so I had this, this vague hope that maybe I would be called upon, or maybe I'd have a chance. But mostly, I wanted to hear him, explain the terrific performance of those tens of thousands of Iraqi army people that he trained so well and equipped so well with our money and our weapons. And why they turned and fled as soon as ISIS shot a AK-47 their way back this time last year. Now, I exaggerate that they didn't all flee. The officers took helicopters out of there, but they got out of Dodge real quick. And I was just wondering how Petraeus feels about that.
Yep. So they're hauling you into court. You got to go tomorrow and... I guess you don't know how far they're proceeding against you. Do you know how many, how much time or how much fines you're possibly facing here?
Well, no, I don't. You see, I was arraigned, and we thought that they'd dismiss the charges. Then I had to come up again on the 8th of December, and we thought again that, particularly once they had seen the footage. They would realize that they had no case, that actually I might have a case. But no, the assistant district attorney said, I'm not authorized to let this fellow do anything other than to plead guilty to these terrible charges. So The next step now is tomorrow. I teach this evening, so I'm taking the last train up out of Union Station in Washington up to New York, and I have to be at the tombs at the Center Street Criminal Court at 9:30. Luckily, I'll be warmly embraced by a lot of my friends in New York City, so I won't be so bad. And we'll see what the judge says this time. I'm really sort of in some wonderment as to how they feel they can brutalize a person of my age just because he wanted his ticket honored to get in to see the sainted David Petraeus. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's funny. It goes to show how paper-thin all of that reverence for all the so-called conservative idols of the military and the intelligence community and so forth. You stand up and say, "Hi, I'm Ray McGovern. I'm a former CIA officer." They'll go, "Oh, wow." And then you say, "Mr. Rumsfeld, so where's the weapons of mass destruction?" And they'll go, "Oh, boo! Oh, we hate you. All of a sudden, you're not our golden calf at all. You're some terrible person using your CIA credential to besmirch our heroes. How dare you?"
You know, I think maybe they remember that, you know, and maybe they just didn't want to take a chance. And so maybe that's a badge of honor there if they're afraid of me. But still, you know, the 92nd Street Y, maybe you have to be from New York City, which I am, to appreciate what the reputation they used to enjoy of free discussion, free speech, all manner of views honored and respected. And I try to get in with a ticket, and they turn me away. I don't know why, but maybe we'll find out. The supreme irony, of course, is that Petraeus, according to press reports based on leaks 3 weeks ago, that he himself could be indicted for far more serious crimes. Ostensibly, it's simply to get him for sharing his CIA computer with his paramour, his mistress Paula Broadwell. I mean, that may seem superficial at first glance, but can you imagine what's in the computer of the head of the CIA, and maybe just less serious, what's in the computer of the fellow commanding troops in Afghanistan, where she busily curried his favor and wrote his biography. So those are serious questions, but I just written an article, which will be on Consortium News in another hour, Scott, which goes through the real things that Petraeus should be called to account for. And those are, of course, a couple of things. One is his endorsement, his carrying the water for Donald Rumsfeld in instituting a policy where we were not supposed to torture people anymore, that is, U.S. soldiers. But if we saw the Iraqis doing it, one to the other, like Sunni to Shia or vice versa, actually, mostly it was Shia to Sunni, then that was okay, because what we were trying to do is to break the Sunni insurrection. Now, we know that, and this is kind of something that not many people know, but we know that because Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, released all those WikiLeaks documents, which were cables from our forces there in Afghanistan and Iraq. And those cables showed that there was a Frago 242. What's that? That's a fragmentary order. Okay. What did that say? That said, "General Petraeus, when you go out to Iraq in June of 2004, you carry these instructions from not the military chain of command, but Donald Rumsfeld. And the instructions are, we're going to break the back of the Sunni insurgency. We're going to give the Shia everything they need to torture the heck out of these people and make them submit." Okay? Now, the odd thing was that the proof of that came 18 months later, when Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was standing with Rumsfeld at a press conference, November 29, 2005. Okay, we're talking June 2004. Here it is, 18 months later, November 29, 2005. There had been some people who had gotten into the Iraqi prisons, and one of the correspondents said, General Pace, what are your instructions? What are your instructions to your soldiers if they see people tortured? And he said, to stop it immediately. And Rumsfeld said, well, I don't think it's to stop it, General Pace. I think it's just to maybe report it if you wish. And Pace says, no, sir, it's to stop it on the spot. Now, Pace was immediately told after the press conference that, whoops, we forgot to tell you, the new orders were not only to condone but to encourage torture of Sunni by Shia, and we just forgot to tell you that, Peter, you didn't get the memo, so, and besides, you don't get a second term as Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman. So that was, you know, one of the most unusual press conferences I have ever seen at the Pentagon, and the proof was in the pudding. Pace was kept out of the, Pace was a pretty straight arrow guy, right? So he kept out of the leadership. Petraeus is running the torture for the Iraqis, and that, you know, that's the kind of thing that he should be tried for, not adultery, as, you know, I don't make light of adultery, but, you know, you have to compare these crimes and their significance when thousands of people are getting killed or tortured. Well, it puts a new light on things.
Yep. All right. Well, we're already into this break, and I want the live audience to hear it too. So hang tight with me right there, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show, talking with Ray McGovern. And yeah, it's true. Petraeus, he lost some wars. He and McChrystal tortured some Iraqis. He lost. He won and lost and won and lost Mosul. And that's why he's the greatest general in American history. Everybody knows that. And, you know, I actually read a thing that said that this whole thing about the CIA leak is just their pro-Jeb coup to try to keep Petraeus out of, well, I guess, I forget what you wrote back then. I know Phil Giraldi wrote that this was basically a CIA coup against their general that Obama had put in power as CIA director, that they were the ones who had their friends at the FBI get rid of this guy for them. Back then in the first place. And then you could see why over at CIA they would always prefer Bushes. And so maybe that's where these charges about the what all was on Paula Broadwell's laptop come from, is trying to weaken Petraeus, because it doesn't matter how many people he tortured or how many wars he lost. The media people love him, and so the American people love him, Ray.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a much more complicated story than Petraeus on Paula Broadwell's laptop, so to speak. I differ with Phil, although I respect him greatly, on how independent the CIA was on this. It seems to me very clear that Petraeus was far too big for his britches, so to speak. I'm not talking about his inflated ego or inflated any other parts there. What I'm talking about here is that Obama was fed up with Petraeus. And so Obama, in my view, said to NSA and to the head of the Mueller, the head of the FBI, look, go get Petraeus. I don't want him out of here. I want him out of here right after I get reelected. Okay. Right after the midterms. So what happens? They go into his emails. Now, there's a cockamamie story about...
Well, now, wait a minute now. Why is it that you believe this came from Obama rather than people lower than Petraeus over at CIA who were tired of, you know, his military attitude and all that kind of thing?
Because as soon as the election was over, Obama told his director of national intelligence to call in Petraeus and tell him, Hey, look here. Here are the transcripts of all your conversations with these lovely ladies. It's time to resign. That's exactly how it happened. They wanted to get rid of him, and they did. Now, for services performed...
Fine with me. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. But
for services performed, the head of NSA, General Alexander, and the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, have landed really important and interesting jobs as highly technical people for Wall Street, ensuring that security is kept on all their emails and so forth like that. And also, you know, there was this Spitzer fellow there who was a real problem for Wall Street. And for services performed in that direction, namely NSA snooping on Spitzer, finding out about the call girl, and destroying him, well, these two guys, Alexander and Mueller, are living in the lap of luxury, making millions each month. And this, the Americans don't know about this, but it was precisely, in my view, for these very loyal services performed when Obama and the White House wanted to get rid of people, or even more important, Wall Street wanted to get rid of people like Spitzer, then they dig into these banks of dragnet type collection emails and other electronic collection things, and that's how it happened. So the supreme irony here is that we know that Petraeus was not very good at email. We know that because he made some really horrid mistakes, which showed him up as a sort of a Zionist devotee, and Max Boot helping him out of the very tough jams. So we know all that, but now we know that he also was vulnerable himself, and no matter how many emails he deleted or thought he had deleted in his conversations with good Paula and all these rich ladies there in Tampa, it was not the case that he deleted them. The government can always get them back. And so this dragnet collection, this bulk collection, is very good for going after people and blackmailing them or getting them to resign. It doesn't stand a chance of preventing a terrorist attack or preventing any other thing before it happens. Very good after it happens, not so good, not good at all before it happens.
Yep. All right, now let's talk about Ukraine, because it's absolutely crazy, and I'll have to keep you one more segment too, if that's all right, through the break here
sure.
to talk about it. But we got this new report coming out, came out yesterday, I guess, or 2 days ago, from the Brookings Institute, saying it's time to start arming the Ukrainian military. And I don't know to what degree we've already been covertly arming them. But anyway, the New York Times says that Obama is certainly considering it. And I wonder, basically, I guess, you know, first of all, what you know about the proposal, what it is that they're trying to convince him to do. That'll probably take us the rest of this segment.
Well, you know, there are people that profit from building and selling and, you know, reaping the profits from arms. And not only the arms dealers, but the congressional authorities that authorize the arms. And we saw some really very convenient little circle here where Congress appropriates the money, the arms dealers manufacture and then deal the arms, and they slice off a part of the profits, give it back to the congressional people, and they get reelected pure and simple. So that's one aspect right there. The other aspect is that these people, you know, with all due respect, I know something about the Soviet Union and Russia, and Stephen Cohen and others whom I respect also know. And either these people are completely dumb about Soviet or Russian strategic interests in this case, or they just don't understand, they just don't give a darn. But this is very, 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 very fragile stuff. This is Russia's sphere of influence, okay? Why the United States and NATO want to interfere in the Ukraine is something that has puzzled the Russians. And Putin himself has said, you know, when we ask that question, they say, well, it's none of your business. It's none of our business. We're weaning Ukraine into the Western orbit. They like the West. That's what they want to do. Now, the worst thing is, that the major media in this country talk about pro-Russian separatists out there in the eastern Ukraine. Well, that's a misnomer. You know, it's not the government against the pro-Russian separatists. It's the coup government supported by fascists, okay? Supported by people who we wouldn't allow into polite society. It's those people against what I call the anti-coup federalists. All the people out there in eastern Ukraine want is a fair shake, a regional autonomy that they can live with. And that's what the Russians are supporting.
All right, now hold it right there, Ray. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Ray McGovern. More on escalation, American escalation of the Ukraine crisis in just a minute. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, talking about the crisis in Ukraine, studied by the Brookings Institution, that's being highly cited and touted as why we need to send weapons to the Ukrainian military to escalate the war against Russia. And I have to say, Ray, you know, I haven't read the whole study, but I heard an interview with Ivo Dadler or something. What's his name? Dadler, the former ambassador to the European Union on NPR yesterday. And I saw a little bit of coverage a couple of days before that. Were these people, and tweets by the fellow travelers too, where they talk like this is a game of checkers or something, I guess chess, fine to be generous to them. But yeah, see, what we're going to do is we think that if we turn this dial here a little bit, then that will make Russia respond this way that we want. And they just sound so stupid. I can't believe it. I can't believe they're talking about the real world, the American Empire and the Russian Federation screwing around over Ukraine. And they're saying, you know, yesterday, for example, I have a quote here. Robert Siegel, who's the greatest pushover in all of American journalism, plays the slightest devil's advocate on NPR yesterday and says, well, what if Russia calls Washington and the Ukraine's bluff on this? And they just say, no, we'll escalate instead. What happens? And the guy, you have to hear it on NPR to hear the tone in his voice as he's desperately searching for some kind of makeshift answer. And he ends up just coming up with basically nothing. Well, hopefully the arms that are being provided would inflict the kind of cost on Russia that would have an impact.
Yeah.
And then I guess that's supposed to mean and then he actually says at the end of the paragraph, he blabs on, and at the end he says, well, it'll make the cost and the debate in Moscow go up. It'll make the debate go up, Ray. Don't you get it? See, our strategy is what we're going to do is we're going to arm the Ukrainian military. And we're going to have them kill a bunch of Russians who we claim are inside Ukraine right now. And who knows, I guess if they're brave, cross the border. And then if the Russians decide they want to fight about it, well, that'll get even more of their guys killed. And then that will make the debate go up. And I'm thinking, seriously, you could have had my seventh grade gym coach decide American foreign policy. That's definition of meathead, know-nothing idiot. What the hell is going on here? This is the guy whose name is first on the list with Michel Flournoy, who also lost the Afghan war with David Petraeus, and the rest of these kooks from center-left Democratic Clintonite Brookings.
Yeah, I'm afraid. I hope that your seventh grade gym teacher is not listening, because you do him a disservice. these people are not quite as bright as whoever he was. It's not funny, really, because it's mad. It's madness. And what they're out to do is poison relations between Obama and Putin, and they've done a really bang-up job of doing that. Now, just a year and a half ago, okay, September 2013, Putin came and bailed Obama out, pulled his chestnuts out of the fire, said, look, you're in a tough position here. You really don't want to wage a war against Syria. We'll help you out. We'll get the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons. Right, says Obama. Yeah, right, says Putin. We can do that for you. Will you stop? We call off the invasion? And Obama says, well, if you can really do that, Kerry says, that'll never happen. Obama says, watch me. Next day, the Syrian foreign minister gets up and says, we are prepared to destroy all our chemical weapons. Now, that was the most recent peak of relations between Putin and Obama. And Putin wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on September 11, 2013, praising the spirit of comradeship, the spirit of cooperation that existed at that particular point in time. Now, we've gone down sharply from that. Why? Well, part of the reason is that the neocons really wanted that war. They really wanted the United States to attack Syria. That's why they mousetrapped Obama into declaring this red line and then made believe that it was the Syrian government that violated the red line and using chemical weapons. And so this was a real setback for the neocons. They came back strong, okay? They came back and they mounted the coup in Kiev. How did they do that? Well, they had trained a lot of these proto-fascists, a lot of these people from the right sector and descendants from the fascists in the old Ukraine under Bandera and others. And they mounted a coup on the plaza there in front of, well, on the Maidan, the plaza there in Kiev. And they did that on the 22nd of February last year. Now, that was the beginning of this latest thing. And that coup, you know, we say that some people say, well, the revolution will not be televised, right? Well, this coup was YouTubeized. 2 weeks before, someone intercepted a conversation between Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and the U.S. Ambassador in Kiev, and Nuland saying, all right, Yats is our guy. Yats is the guy who knows how to do austerity. He was head of the central bank. You tell these other Klitschko and these other people to wait in the wings. Yats is our guy. Now, that was put on YouTube 2 weeks before the election. So, I mean, 2 weeks before the coup, the reversal of the Democratic election. What happens? McGovern wakes up on the 23rd of February and hears the radio saying, new prime minister in Ukraine. There's been a putsch. There's been a coup, and it's Yats, yep. Yatsenyuk. And he's still our guy there. He's still the prime minister. So that's where it started. Now,
audience, I'm going to play for you the Nuland audio and also Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, the day after the coup, gloating all about it on the Colbert Show and explaining how it happened. So stay tuned for that in the next segment. I'm sorry, Ray, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Nuland uses some very bad profanity that I wouldn't want my grandchildren to hear as she tells what should happen.
Well, I faded that part out. You can still hear the F, but that's all.
Okay. Well, the point is simply this. Western media, it's not that they've fallen down here. They're doing the same thing that they did before the war in Iraq. They're beating the drums for war. And this time is not against some tin horn dictator. This time it's against a nuclear capable country. It's not going to be pushed around in their own neighborhood. Okay. So when the BBC calls a couple months ago, I'm in Moscow at a conference and they call, okay, come on. Can you talk about Ukraine? Sure, I can. They say, well, what do you think of the seizure, the aggression against Crimea? And I said, well, why do you want to start in the third inning? I said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you know, you don't start in the third inning with the seizure of Crimea. You start with the coup d'etat in Kiev on the 22nd of February. That's where you start. That's what what set all this stuff in motion. And so that's the narrative that you get.
Right. Same exact thing on the NPR story from yesterday, which I have the text of it here, where, hey, at every stage of this, from the seizure of Crimea through the arming of the rebels, it's all been Russian escalation. Well, escalation of what? The crisis America created. Oh, okay. Make sure and leave that part out.
You know what I find curious in looking at this thing? I've just been halfway into it and read the executive summary. Nowhere is mentioned the Malaysian Flight 17, which Kerry went on all the Sunday shows and accused the Russians of Russian missiles and Russian separatists and all that stuff of doing. The evidence is getting conveniently obscured now because it's becoming clearer and clearer, at least to me, that this was not what Kerry said it was. The Russians are not responsible for these things. It was probably the Ukrainian Air Force itself that shot down that plane. We'll learn about that, hopefully, within the next several months.
Yep. All right. Sorry, we got to stop there, but thanks so much for your time, Ray. I sure appreciate it.
Most welcome.
You're the best, man. That's Ray McGovern, y'all. He's at ConsortiumNews.com and RayMcGovern.com. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I don't know. I guess I could have kept Ray on. I wanted to play this audio for you. I played it before, but it seems important. You know, really, let me say this before I hit the audio. You got Ray McGovern and Robert Perry at Consortium News. You got Patrick L. Smith at Salon.com. You got James Carden and Daniel Larrison at the American Conservative Magazine. You got Pat Buchanan. You got Justin at antiwar.com. And actually, you know, I don't even think I've seen anything at the World Socialist site about this. Usually they come up, not that I look at their site, but they come up in Google results pretty often. But honestly, I think I just listed everybody I know. Did I say James Carden? Yeah, James Carden. He's also at the National Interest. Paul Pilar. Anyway. That's everyone I can name who's good on Ukraine. Oh, John Mearsheimer. He wrote a decent thing for Foreign Affairs about it. Here's John Mearsheimer's editor at Foreign Affairs. And if you're familiar, the Council on Foreign Relations is the Morgan-founded center of the American foreign policy establishment after World War I. And it's the most starched of all the think tanks, basically. And here's the editor of Foreign Affairs, their journal, Gideon Rose, on the Colbert Show. And this is from February the 24th of last year. So just 2 days after a Nazi, yes, real, no fooling, Hitler loving, SS lightning bolt, Jew and black people hating Nazis, overthrew the government there, taking credit for the United States getting away with bloody murder. Oh, sure. Take your sweet time playing then.
Uh-huh. It's basically Robin to Russia's Batman. And the challenge here is to try to attract it to the West, to get it to flip sides.
Is America taking sides in this in any way? If these people, if the rebels are winning right now, right?
Yes, just recently.
Why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and calling Putin and saying, hey, you might have won the medal count, but we won the country count, biatch.
It's actually a very good question, and the answer is that we don't want Russia to intervene and kick over the table like a game of Risk and take Ukraine back.
And so would they do that? Could he send in troops?
Yes, he could. So we are choosing.
Does Ukraine have any troops of their own? Would they fight back?
Yes, but we don't want this to escalate, and we don't want Russia to crack down. So we want to basically distract Russia. Oh, look, you have the highest medal count. Oh, you did really well. And
is that
you know,
possible?
Focus on the Olympics.
Here's a shiny object. We'll just take an entire country away from you.
Basically.
Now, there's a power vacuum right now.
There's a power vacuum. The opposition is all together, which everybody, it's easy to agree on getting rid of the bad old regime and much harder to create a stable country in which everybody compromises and moves forward. The
Find
reason we don't want, we don't want Putin to get involved in this. And so we are basically, we want to try and involve him in this decision so that he allows Ukraine to go. We actually want to not, we want to say we want a non-exclusive relationship with Ukraine. You can have a relationship with it too.
You're the only one making this into a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship.
Ukraine is basically choosing its future between two completely different courses of action. And we're trying to blur that choice so the old boyfriend doesn't get too upset when it makes the right choice towards us.
He might punch us in the face. Well, thank you so much, Gideon Rose. Gideon Rose, Foreign Affairs Magazine.
All right, so there you go. Look at the last year and see how well that worked out. First, they overthrew the democratically elected government. Then the first thing they did was try to outlaw Russian and as a language. And the people of the East said, screw you. And the government in Kiev immediately sent Nazi killers to murder those who would defy them. And that's how the war started. And Vladimir Putin said, you know what? Marines and sailors at the base in Sevastopol, go outside. They didn't invade Crimea. They were already there. Crimea has belonged to Russia since the days of the Articles of Confederation, actually. The 1780s, before the Constitution was ever ratified in America. And, you know, I was just reading a thing the other day about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men they lost fighting the Nazis for Crimea during World War II. You think Texans love the Alamo? And Putin himself said it in a speech. He said, you know, I thought about, would it be nice to go and visit our NATO friends down at Sevastopol at our old Navy base where now it's their Navy base? And I thought, you know, I love NATO. I love these guys. But do I want to go and visit them at the Sevastopol base? Nope. That'd be a bridge too far. Thanks. What was that madman thinking? The madman was thinking, no, you can't have my naval base. What did you think he was going to do? You listen to Gideon Rose. He's obviously speaking for the consensus. The American establishment who got this thing done. Or maybe, you know, he just finished talking with Max Boot. Does Max Boot count as the establishment? I guess so. Anyway. So what we're trying to do is we're stealing Ukraine away from Russia's sphere of influence, which is impossible and ridiculous. And we're going to do it in such a way where Russia goes along with it. Oh, okay. And that such a way is send Ukrainian Nazis east to kill. Yeah. And now here we are a year later after this absolute failure. If you compare the policy results to what Gideon Rose said the policy was, it's been an absolute catastrophe. And now all they can say, just like in our interview with Kelly Riddell earlier, all they can say is we can't turn back now. We lose face. Let Gaddafi live, but out of power? No, because we would look bad. Think about the optics. Nope, we got to do the war. Same kind of thing here. The optics. God, don't you just want to smack people when they say that? Except Gareth. I guess I forgive Gareth just because I love him so much anyway. But God, I hate that. Optics. Just say how it looks. How it looks. So anyway, that's the thing. It's all America's fault. They started it. They told the Ukrainian government, you have to have a trade deal with us or a trade deal with Russia. You can't have both. If you sign a trade deal with Russia, then we withdraw our offer. And so he chose them. And so then the pro-NATO faction in Ukraine, pro-EU faction in Ukraine, started a riot. And then the Nazis showed up, too. And then guess what? The moderates don't fight. It's the extremists that do the fighting. Funny how we never seem to learn that lesson. And so, as far as I know, or I don't know. No, I guess not. I was going to say maybe they really meant it when they offered the deal to keep him till December, but that's not really true because there's that great Der Spiegel article where they explain how the Americans told every billionaire, and even in the east of Ukraine, they told them all that if you don't, they were the guys from the Party of Regions, is the guys from the east that had won the election of 2010. But the Americans and the Europeans, I guess the Germans, told them, we will put absolute sanctions on you individually. We will seize every last dollar that you have out of the country if you don't forsake Yanukovych right now. And so they did. And at that point, the Party of Regions gave up on him in the parliament, and then the Nazis moved forward out in the square. Part of the deal was you have to pull your police back. Well, pull your police back. Okay, fine. How about you pull your Nazis back? Oops. That didn't work so well. The head of Stratfor told a Russian paper. It was a German paper interviewed him. He said this is the most blatant coup d'etat in world history or something like that. But anyway, nope, like Ray McGovern said, now the entire crisis started, I don't know, how about yesterday? Russian aggression, Russian aggression. Anyway, sorry, I'm running out of time. Here's one of these clips in Newland.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
Oh, hell, here's the whole thing.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yachts. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Klitsch should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think... in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call, but you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, the 3+1 conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I think, I mean, that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got, and he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write
yeah.
you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.